It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The CDC reports that more than 107,000 Americans died from drug overdoses in 2021, a nearly 15% increase from a year earlier, and an unenviable all-time record. Pennsylvania remains in the top five states for the most fatal overdoses. Joining us now is the Secretary of Drug and Alcohol Programs for the Commonwealth, Jennifer Smith. Welcome back to the Confluence.
Good morning, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
When you heard that record number of drug deaths, I assume you weren't surprised, but were you disheartened, discouraged?
Yeah, certainly not surprised. Me and my colleagues across the nation are constantly monitoring overdose deaths and even non-fatal overdoses. So it certainly wasn't a shock, but it absolutely is disheartening. So much work has been done to try to address what was the opioid crisis now has morphed into more of an addiction crisis. I think what's important for all of us to remember is that there really is still a lot of hope that comes with recovery from substance use disorder. So even though keeping an eye on the statistics is really important and doubling down on efforts, it's also important to remember that there are many individuals who see recovery from this disease, and there's a lot of hope in that.
Here in Pennsylvania, the number of fatalities dipped to below 4,500 in 2018 and 19, but jumped again above 5,000 in 2020. Any idea of why the rise after that two-year decrease?
Yeah, we believe there's really kind of two primary reasons for that, one of which I'm sure people are tired of hearing about, but COVID-19 played a big part in overdose deaths in 2020. Financial instability, isolation, lack of access to services was all part of what people experienced during the pandemic. But the second reason that we believe we saw a spike in some of those deaths was the pervasiveness of a substance called fentanyl. It's much more deadly than heroin, and it is being mixed with almost all substances now, including methamphetamine and cocaine and marijuana. And because it is so deadly, we are unfortunately seeing more fatal overdoses than we were previously.
The state outlaws test strips, which allow people to detect the presence of fentanyl, as you say, among other drugs when it's mixed in, such as heroin or cocaine. Essentially, this would mean someone who purchased an illegal drug, an illicit drug, could detect if this potentially deadly substance, fentanyl, was in it. Senate Bill 845 that passed the Judiciary Committee would legalize these strips. Does your office support the legislation?
Yeah, 100%, right? This is a really proven effective harm reduction strategy for people who use drugs to be able to understand how harmful the substances are that they might be using. And it allows them to prepare for that. So either have naloxone at the ready, use with another person to ensure there's someone there to call for help, or potentially lower the amount of the substance that they're using.
So have you testified before the Senate in making this case? And what has been their response to you saying this could help?
Yeah, I've testified in a number of different settings about this issue and some others in the harm reduction space. I think generally it has been met fairly warmly. I mean, the reality is there's science behind this methodology of harm reduction. It scientifically has been proven to reduce the potential harm in terms of overdose death. So it's kind of hard to argue against the facts.
Are you hopeful it will get, these strips will get legalized? And if so, when?
Absolutely. At this point, it really rests in the hands of the General Assembly. This is a tough time of year for them. They're very busy trying to work out a budget to make sure that we have a budget before July 1.
And but get reelected.
Hopeful. Yeah, well, that too. I'm hopeful that this session they'll be able to get that legislation passed.
Okay. So you mentioned when you were talking about the numbers and being disheartened, you also mentioned about all the work that's going in. So what is your office doing to help make sure that people who use drugs are able to keep themselves safe, not just directing them to rehab? I mean, ensuring that they have access to harm reduction tools, such as the test strips, clean equipment, et cetera.
Yeah, Kevin, I could probably do a four-hour segment with you about all the things that we're doing. One of them is really addressing the root of stigma, which is the reason that so many people don't access resources and services. So we're doing a really big project to address stigma around addiction. Then we are doing what we can in the harm reduction space in terms of getting as much naloxone out into communities as possible, talking about the Good Samaritan law. But really, we do need some legislation to really take drastic steps in the harm reduction space. So in addition to the fentanyl test strip bill that you talked about, there's another bill around legalizing syringe service programs. And this is a really fantastic way of minimizing the spread of hepatitis C and HIV. So lots of different things happening, but that's what's going on in the harm reduction space.
You mentioned the opioid crisis. Have people gotten tired of hearing about crisis, especially with something has gone goes on and on and on and doesn't seem to have an end? So are those messages that you're trying to get out starting to, you know, get ignored or not acted upon as quickly as you might like?
I think it is hard. I will say, though, that I think people are excited to talk about something other than COVID. And so even though we've been talking about the opioid crisis for a long time, it's somewhat fresh because it's something that's not COVID-19. So we're really trying to capitalize on the momentum of, you know, trying to reinvigorate efforts to address the addiction crisis here in Pennsylvania.
Secretary Smith, you have said that 5,000 deaths a year are unacceptable. So what are the steps that can be done right now and maybe additional steps that will make it not the deaths acceptable, but reduce those number of deaths?
I think what we talked about with harm reduction is a huge first step. I also think normalizing the conversation about addiction, reducing that stigma, and allowing people to feel okay to ask for help and to admit when maybe they're a person in recovery who's experiencing a recurrence of use. We really have to normalize the conversation about this as a medical disease and make it okay for people to ask for help.
Jennifer Smith is the Secretary of Drug and Alcohol Programs for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Secretary, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. Nationwide, families are struggling to find formula to feed their infants. This is particularly complicated for those with premature or sick babies that might need specialized food. Local milk banks are also seeing an increase in those requests for human milk to help meet the need. Denise O'Connor is the founder and executive director of the Mid-Atlantic Mother's Milk Bank, which serves Pennsylvania and the surrounding states of West Virginia and parts of New Jersey, Maryland, and Delaware. Welcome, Denise.
Oh, hello, and thank you for having us here today, because anything that brings to into the attention of this important medical service, we're excited. But although it's unfortunate that's under these circumstances, it's a very stressful time for families right now.
Yeah, it is. So I'm just wondering really quickly, can you describe how a milk bank works? Do people maybe think of it the same way as maybe like a food bank or something?
Sure. The best analogy I can make is that we're sort of like a blood bank, but we're for human milk. So what we do is we get milk from carefully screened volunteer donors. Our generous donors are what makes the milk bank possible. And then we take that milk and we test it, we bottle it, and then we pasteurize it. We pasteurize it at a low temperature, which inactivates pathogens like bacteria and viruses and keeps all the bioactivity. And then the hospitals use it in the NICUs.
So you mentioned the hospitals use it, but can anyone request human milk from you?
Sure. About 75% of what we do is the hospitals. The other 25% is outpatients. Donor milk does require a prescription. And so our space is typically the babies with medical needs.
Okay. So the people who typically need milk from the milk bank is what you're saying are people that have infants with medical needs.
Exactly. So lots of different reasons why a baby on an outpatient side of things may need milk, may have severe allergies or GI conditions, cardiac conditions, things like that.
So at the top, I mentioned the formula shortage. Has your organization seen an increase in demand for human milk?
Oh, absolutely. The hospitals are having to lean on us more heavily. So we're seeing a good 20-25% uptick in their usage, and then outpatient requests as well. More children who have, you know, complex medical needs that can't find their specialty formulas. Some conditions have special formulas that they need, and those are affected by the recall. And so we're having those families reach out to us.
And so when you say 20 to 25%, that was just over weeks?
Oh, just over a few weeks. Since opening our doors in 2016, we've had a pretty steep growth trajectory because Donor Milk was new to this region and we've really been seeing it evolve. But on top of that, in the last few weeks, we've been seeing a marked increase in demand on the inpatient and outpatient side.
So for those that have been reaching out to you, they might be desperate to feed their babies at this point. A switch to human milk has to be okayed by a pediatrician.
Right. A prescription is required by our accrediting body, the Human Milk Banking Association of North America. And the state of Pennsylvania also regulates milk banks. And so we're required by law that there needs to be a prescription. Also, we find that insurance does pay for a lot of the medically necessary donor milk. So a pre-authorization to the insurer may actually be required as well.
And how much does human milk cost per ounce?
Sure. So the milk itself is free because it is donated. It is the milk processing fees that are charged, everything that we need to do to make the milk safe for fragile babies. And we charge exactly what that cost is because we're a nonprofit. And so the average processing fees across the country are $4.50 an ounce. And we're a little bit below that.
An ounce. So babies eat how many ounces a day?
Yeah, well, little babies in the NICU, by the teaspoonful. But babies on the outpatient side of things, they're drinking, you know, 25, 30 ounces a day. But donor milk is a medical service. It is just as important as blood is to someone who needs blood. Human milk is the same. And for those babies, it keeps babies out of the hospital, changes their medical outcomes, their health outcomes.
And you said insurance does cover donor milk, or is it not uniform?
It's not uniform. There are some health plans that do a great job at covering donor milk. They actually have criteria that their plans have developed of when they cover it, and then some plans don't cover it at all. So there's a lot of variability. So there's a lot of gaps. We have charitable care programs in place, but, you know, we're a little nonprofit. We got to keep the lights on. And so those programs are available just because of generous financial contributors. But this is a serious medical service and should be covered and treated as such.
And is there legislation to address that?
Well, there is. So in October, HB 2017 was introduced by Wendy Thomas and Austin Davis. And now just yesterday, you can see on the Senate site of Pennsylvania website is that there's a companion Senate bill that was just introduced by Senator Michelle Brooks. So we're really excited. It's a mandate for insurance coverage for the inpatients and outpatients with certain medical conditions. It will alleviate a lot of equity and access issues.
So, you know, earlier we're talking about the formula shortage and then increased demand for human milk, both on the hospital side and the outpatient side. But are you seeing an increase in supply to meet that demand? Because this milk, it comes from lactating parents, people that donate it.
Right. And boy, parents are stepping up. We always have a continual need for donor milk, of course. But some of the media attention we've been getting, we have been getting increased calls to the milk bank. And we certainly hope those keep coming because we, a lot of this increased demand is going to be sustained. And we need to make sure we have enough milk for the babies.
And just really briefly, who are the types of people that can donate milk?
Just simply healthy lactating people that have more milk than their own babies need. If moms want to visit midatlanticmilkbank.org and just click on the donation page, there'll be lots of information. It's an easy process.
And then finally, What are some of the supports, briefly, that your organization might need right now to meet the demand?
Again, just getting the word out. We are, you know, laser focused on access issues. So we certainly are encouraging folks to, you know, reach out to their legislators about SB 1202 and HB 2017 to make sure that we alleviate those access issues. And we just keep doing what we're doing every day, processing milk and doing what we can to fulfill as many needs as we can.
Okay. Denise O'Connor is the founder and executive director of the Mid-Atlantic Mother's Milk Bank. Denise, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh City Council is exploring how to address the need for affordable housing, at least in part, through collective ownership. WESA senior reporter Margaret J. Krause has been looking into efforts to revive this type of housing. Welcome back to the program, Margaret.
Thank you, Kevin.
Margaret, city councilors considering limited equity cooperatives, LECs. What are they?
So limited equity cooperatives are like buying a ticket to more affordable housing. So people buy a share in the corporation that owns the cooperative, and that share is typically far lower than a home down payment. It could be as little as $1,000 or $2,000, which, you know, is more like the security deposit for an apartment these days. And then the monthly costs are also typically lower than a normal market rate rent or a mortgage per month. And so it's a democratically controlled, more affordable way to have a long-term housing solution.
I mean, a share. I mean, I'm thinking of stocks and shares like that. I mean, do you own it? Can you increase your share? Does it go up as you make those monthly share payments?
Well, so there are a couple of different kinds of cooperatives, but in this case, limited equity cooperatives, you own this share, and the value, what it can be resold for if you should choose to leave, is determined by the board, your neighbors who govern the cooperative. And so typically, however, what happens if you sell your share, you get your share back and accrued interest. However, the resale value is limited in order to keep it affordable. The idea is to create. Now, so it's not a huge wealth building vehicle the way that Americans typically think of buying a home. However, research has shown that people tend to have an easier time saving because they have this predictable monthly lower cost.
I mentioned an attempt at revival. So this isn't a new program to Pittsburgh?
No. So it's a program in as much as, you know, these projects need financing. But it's not the way that we normally think of like a housing program. They were fairly common after World War II. It was a way for people to have this. I'm sorry, you said own your unit. You own your share and you have a right to live in a designated unit. Sorry to just clear that up.
Right.
So it's an old idea. And there are still some operating in Pittsburgh today, and counselors are wondering, perhaps we can support their extension, the creation of more of them.
Mm-hmm. Any idea why it, I don't want to say fell out of favor, but wasn't used as much in the last number of decades?
You know, it's a fabulous question, and I actually failed to get really good answers on that, so I don't know for sure. However, I would say that probably the sort of exodus from the cities in the latter half of the 20th century before there was a revival probably played a role. I would imagine that wealth building through home ownership is kind of the American primary means of building wealth probably played a role. But again, that is speculation. So I don't have a great answer for you there.
Well, you'll find out if anybody does. Margaret, who are the proponents bringing more limited equity cooperatives to the city? Who's really behind this?
Sure. So Council President Teresa Kale Smith and Councilor Deb Gross both have an interest in this. They jointly introduced a resolution to look at, you know, are there regulatory hurdles on our books that would make this harder to do? What are the shared characteristics across cooperatives that currently exist in Pittsburgh? You know, how many are there? So they're gathering information and interested in having this discussion.
Where have such cooperatives been successful, whether they've been in the other parts of the state or outside of Pennsylvania?
Sure. So, like I said, they are not a new idea, which means that they are in many different places. However, the places where they've been most successful tend to be places where the city, the municipality has a law on their books that says, hey, if a landlord is going to sell, you have to give your current tenants the first dibs on buying the building. But so they've been very successful in DC. There's about 100 there, according to a 2020 study, around about then. And that's a city of 700,000 people. So it's not a huge number. New York, of course, has cooperatives. Those can be different than limited equity cooperatives. As I said, there's a couple different kinds. But so yeah, they're kind of all over in terms of density. It varies.
Okay. Margaret, you spoke to Amanda Uron, an associate professor who actually lives in a cooperative. What's her take on this type of housing?
She used to live in a cooperative. I don't know that she currently does. Okay. That it is not like all of the tools being targeted toward the country's housing crisis. It is not a panacea. It is not a silver bullet. However, it can be a way for people to have long-term affordable housing, and control over where they live and how where they live functions.
Mayor Ganey's transition team recommended that members of City Housing Authority Board resign so the mayor can appoint his own team. Does this recommendation and then this study signal a shift in how the city might be addressing affordable housing?
I think what it tells us is that everyone is looking for ways to address the shortage of units. The market is really hard for everyone, but especially if you don't have many resources to put toward housing. And I think there's this real recognition that there are solutions out there. They probably all have to be put into play, and that there's not much time to lose because people are really struggling. And if Mayor Ganey wants to build a city for all, part of that is maintaining economic diversity. And thus, whatever can be done, it seems like people are just throwing solutions out there to begin moving.
Margaret J. Krause is WESA senior reporter covering development and transportation. Margaret, thanks as always.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, we take a close look at today's primary election results, which will have a major impact on which party controls the governor's office and possibly majority in the U.S. Senate. Thanks to our team, Nick Konopka, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.